This episode of Voyager is sponsored by Valo Group. Valo Group is an award-winning fundraising agency. They are experts at raising money because they know how to ask. With a combined 30-plus years of expertise in fundraising, psychology, conflict resolution, storytelling, and DEI, they can help you formulate your purpose, pitch your story, and generate revenue. They customize programming for each client and will teach you to pitch partnerships with confidence and persuasion. Learn more at thevalogroup.com.
Kim Uick, thank you for coming down to Atlanta.
Yeah, it's great, to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, we were talking actually over breakfast with Robin. We were talking about, so you have this interesting story taking Spanish at Davidson College, and you had this interesting Spanish partner who should owe all of his success to you. Right?
I mean, I think if you were a Davidson student between the years of 2006 to 2009-ish, you have a story claiming credit for Steph Curry.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I have mine.
So how did that happen? You're a sophomore. Yes. This is his first class?
It had to be one of his first classes. It was the first day of Spanish 101, and he was sitting next to me, and we got paired up to speak in Spanish, which, if you know anything about Davidson College, the standards are sky high. I mean, it's Spanish 101. Yeah. We don't know how to say azul yet. And right. Here we are trying to talk in Spanish. So Steph and I stumbled through some pretty pathetic Spanish early in his time at Davidson.
That's pretty funny. And you were thinking he was a walk-on, right?
Yeah, well, I think he tried to get the words baloncesto out of his mouth, and I looked at him and, you know, I thought we had a pretty good team and I was pretty proud of it and thought, oh, that's sweet that you think, you know, he wasn't very tall, and that's sweet that you're on the basketball team. Are you a walk-on?
That's so funny.
But Davidson's tiny. I mean, it was 1,600 kids, and I didn't know
it was that small.
Oh, I think it's gotten a little bigger, but I think I remember Steph saying somewhere that he knew like 80% of the student body by name. So he made all of us feel special.
Okay.
Even if we were just the Spanish partner, you know, he made us feel that way.
That's so funny. Okay. So you went to Davidson. I want you to walk a little bit through just so people know who you are.
Yeah.
Went to Davidson. You did your master's work at UT Austin.
Yes.
So how did you end up at Davidson? You're originally from Texas, right?
Yeah. And I was looking at schools, and my mom, who was always so on top of things, had friends who had sent their kids to Davidson, and I was thinking I was going to be pre-med at the time, which now looking back on it is hysterical, because if there is a needle or a picture of a needle or the word needle within 5 miles of me, I pass out cold. Like, pathetically, man. I think the worst time was trying to give blood and the finger prick got me, you know, I'm just pathetic. But for some reason, I thought I could be pre-med, and Davidson was really known for that. So we came up and visited, and I just fell in love with it. So,
okay. Yeah. So you lived in Houston.
Yep.
Right? Your dad was with NASA at the time?
Yep.
Okay. And he's been in space, right?
He has. Okay. He has. He flew 4 times, and it's so funny, because if you were to have my dad on a podcast, which he would never do, you would get through hours before you would know that about him. You know, he just,
very humble.
Yeah, it's just not what he leads with. But I think the way to sum up my dad, I don't even know if he knows this story. So Dad, I hope you're listening, but there was a female astronaut who, was like family to me. And when I was in college, she told me that everyone wanted to fly with my dad, that everyone wanted to be assigned to his crews. And my dad's a really just exceptional pilot, you know, one of the great talents of his generation. I think I could say that. And I don't think even he could refute it as much as he would blush. But the reason that people wanted to be with him was because of how he led, and how he made them feel and his character. And I think of all the things that he has done in his career, that was maybe the time that I was the proudest, just to hear that people people wanted to be near him and people wanted to be led by him. And, you know, my mom is of the same mold, just an incredible leader, an incredible person of character. She's just an exceptional coach. She just coached a Paralympian to a bronze medal, actually.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, just what she's never done before. She was an incredible swimmer growing up, all American, just amazing. And my parents live in this tiny little town, and people just find her. So I think growing up with parents that exude, you know, this podcast is about leadership. They really taught me the most important things about leadership, that it's not about your power or your influence, but how you treat people and your character. And it was a really special. Houston was a special place to grow up. My house was a special place to grow up, for sure.
Didn't you say your dad would fly in to meet with you
at Davidson? So dad had to keep his flight hours up as a pilot. And so he would fly into a little local airport near Davidson and have lunch with me, which was very sweet because I was so homesick. And so he would do that, and it was really fun.
That's crazy. And your mom and your dad both were Navy, right?
Yeah, they both went to the Naval Academy.
Okay. Okay. Wow. Okay, so also talk a little bit about, what does a day in the life of Kim Muick look like right now? And we're gonna dive into some other things, but what does it look like right now for you?
So I have a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 2-year-old, and they are in preschool and first grade. So the vast majority of my time, I mean, really, it's a really hard question, Travis, because I don't know whether to say car line or looking for shoes, because really it's, you know, my daughter, I ask her to get her shoes on, and without fail, she like looks to the sky. I don't know if it's an existential question for her, but my 4-year-old will tell her, Ellie, they're not on the ceiling. Like, that's not where your shoes are. So I spend a lot of time chasing down her shoes and sitting in transportation with my kids.
Oh my gosh.
And then just, doing the mom thing is definitely the majority of my time. And anything else that I do is really from a margin, you know, a very, very small margin.
Yeah. I mean, you brought that up. So we were talking about this briefly beforehand, but talk a little bit about leading from margin, where you're at right now.
Yeah.
You're in a season of motherhood.
Yeah.
I know that you've talked about some educational reform at Mecklenburg Public Schools, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you talk about that, or what part of that can you share?
Sure. Sure. So, I taught in Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools for a number of years, and, you know, it's an imperfect district, but really some phenomenal people there. Mm-hmm. And I really believe in some of the leadership, and I love the students, and that's where they are. So I'm pretty passionate about our public school district. And I also was mentoring a group of kids in a ministry that my husband and I started. And I had this one kid who, again, is going to hate me for saying it. Sorry, Edgar. The whole world knows now. But this brilliant young man named Edgar, who really is like part of our family, his sister and his cousin are my kids' babysitters. You know, I've watched him grow up. And one of the things that I love most about him is that he is hysterically funny and never at anyone else's expense. You know, those people that like make you laugh and it's never mean, which I think just, you have to be so smart. And so special to be that way. Anyway, Edgar's brilliant, and I've been mentoring him for a while, and he was scoring in these crazy high percentiles on his end of grade tests, especially in mathematics. But he had never taken an honors course before until I bribed him his junior year. And that was something that always bothered me, that he had never been put into these honors courses. And I started digging, you know, when I taught in Charlotte Mecklenburg, I was in elementary school. And so I started looking into how do kids get into certain tracks? You know, how do kids get into certain classes? And what I realized is he was able to get into those classes, but he had to get a parent signature. He had to fill out the form. He had to get a teacher recommendation. And not many 14 and 15 year old boys are knocking on their school counselor's door saying, hey, I really like harder classes. Can you put me in a harder class, please? So that troubled me a little bit. And I had this idea of, what if we changed that so that kids who were scoring at a certain percentile or making certain grades were automatically put into a harder course the next year? and they could still opt out. I don't believe in forcing kids into hard classes. They could still opt out. Their family could still opt them out. There's a million good reasons to not take an AP class. But the kids' capability shouldn't be one of them. So what if we change that? What if you score in the top 10% on an end of grade test, you're automatically enrolled in the, you know, maybe then we'll have kids trying to bomb on purpose. I don't know. But I just had this crazy idea, but I had multiple little kids at home. I'm not in a position of leadership in the school district. I don't have a job that lets me speak into that, but I was asked to be a part of this committee called the Equity Committee, where we could raise questions and ideas across the city. And I got on my subcommittee first Zoom call. And I don't know if I said anything the whole time because I was so intimidated. Everyone was a nonprofit leader or had written books. And I was a stay-at-home mom who used to be a teacher. But I had this idea. And I didn't bring it up for a while. And we had a lot of different values-based discussions. First, we talk about, you know, what the problems were, what our values were. And a good number, these people were just extraordinary. And several weeks in, you know, I finally brought this up. And I think at that point, everyone in the Zoom call had an Edgar in their mind of a kid that they loved, who wasn't in the right courses.
Right.
And we kind of, I think probably at that point, maybe everyone felt ownership of this idea of making this change. And it was brought forward, and we worked with this amazing executive in the school district who is just so generous. And, you know, maybe one day I'll realize that he was doing this all along and just trying to be kind to me about my role in this. But, they started doing it with Math One across Charlotte, and, just a couple, you know, I rolled off this equity committee, don't have a lot of capacity right now. It was not going to be a long-term commitment. And I logged into the public meeting that anybody can watch. And they were discussing at that exact moment, this idea of opting kids into harder courses. And I think that was a really humbling moment for me, that leadership is not always about a job or a title. And that a group of people can have an impact, and, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. Things are complicated, but it was just a really big encouragement from the little margin.
You said, I mean, you do a little bit, and we could talk about your writing, and I know you've published some things. You said you were doing some writing recently for the Charlotte Observer from your rocking chair, right? Yeah. Rocking one of your children, right?
Yeah.
Are you like typing with one hand? What are you?
Yeah.
You...
Well, he's pretty, you know, my baby is, he's two, and I treat him like he's still a baby, so I can hold on to the snuggle. So really he can hold his own bottle. He really shouldn't have a bottle anymore, but I was rocking him to sleep. And, I just wrote like a quick op-ed in the notes section on my phone about, TikTok and gun violence and some things that were happening at my daughter's school, and submitted it to the Observer. It was just a really quick op-ed, but it was one of those, again, with my academic background, I think I always felt this pressure of, if you're going to do something, you got to do it right. And it better be well-sourced, and it better be, you know, perfect and ready for publication in a peer-reviewed journal. And that can be a little bit paralyzing when you don't have that margin in your life. Right. So I think the last few years since I had kids has been a lot about still wanting to do things right, but kind of letting go of the fear of it being perfect.
Okay.
Doing it when you can, even in a rocking chair.
And I'm glad you brought up TikTok, which everybody, I mean, if you're young, you have a TikTok account, and we're going to talk about social media ethics, which is actually where I first heard you, on a podcast talking about how many rules for social media?
Oh my goodness, too many.
Okay. But it was kind of a grid of how to approach, yeah, you know, if you're going to be involved in different media platforms, where do you need a grid to be able to look through? So we'll talk about that in a minute. But you talked about your education. You mentioned it. So you've had an interesting, yeah, career path. You've got a master's in education from UT Austin in special education, autism, and developmental disabilities and behavioral analysis.
Yes.
You're an educator. You're a leader in your church. You've served as an applied behavior analysis consultant. Can you just walk through your career, your education and your career just a little sure. bit? You know, you already mentioned you started at Davidson and you contributed to Steph Curry's success in the NBA. So, you know, walk me through your education and why did you study what you ended up studying?
Yeah. So I entered Davidson and I was a psych major really early on with an interest in autism. I worked with a little boy with autism all 4 years. And Davidson is really unique because there's no university. So undergrads get some really hands-on research experience in a way that's, I think, really special. I didn't realize it was really special when I was there. So I spent a lot of time in a rat lab. I spent time doing, my senior thesis was a meta-analysis, which when I got to graduate school, I realized I had done completely incorrectly, oh, wow. but I still did it. So I had done some pretty heavy research type work, research design at Davidson, and then went on to get my master's right after it at UT Austin, which was so fun, really special program. UT is huge, but this program only had 10 girls in it. It was a really special group of women. So I did my master's there. I actually started a PhD, left that, really wanted to be working directly with kids. And then I spent a couple years as a consultant working with young children with autism. And
what did that look like?
So
serving as a, you said yeah. 2 years as a consultant. Uh-huh. So what was that like?
So I would go in and assess mostly early childhood, okay. Assess a kiddo, and mainly communication was a big area of interest for me. And with communication, you know, some children would use like a problematic behavior like self-injury as communication. And so really trying to figure out, hopefully in a way that is really dignifying that, hey, this isn't just a problem behavior. They're trying to tell us something. Like what are they trying to tell us? Are they trying to tell us that they're hungry? Are they trying to tell us that they want something they don't have access to, or are they trying to get our attention? And it was really striking that almost really, truly every time we were able to find a communicative need that behavior was expressing and then replace it with something that wasn't painful or detrimental to the kid. So that was a big part of what I did. And then I would supervise, like I'd write a program of communication instruction that was broken down into really little chunks, and then supervise people who were implementing it. And then there were some kids I got to work with directly and did some social skills things. And yeah, it was fun.
You've published a little bit.
Yeah.
While you were working for, was it the May Institute that yes. you were working for? Mm-hmm. And I knew you did a book review while you were yeah. working with them, but what have you written about?
So
what are you writing about? What have you written about?
When I was at May, I had this one client, this beautiful little girl who had Rett syndrome, which is, at the time, it was still considered on the autism spectrum. I'm way behind now. I don't know if it still is, but it's a really unique collection of symptoms. And one of the things that's really hard is that kids lose control of their hands. So a lot of times children who cannot speak vocally, we can train them to use their hands on like a touchscreen device or a picture exchange system. And she wasn't able to do that. And so a lot of people assumed that there wasn't a lot going on mentally with some of these kids. And there were a lot of people questioning that and thinking there's probably more happening than we realize. And so she actually qualified for an eye gaze communication system where she could look at a screen and focus her eyes for a few seconds on an image. And then that would be emitted from a speaker. So she could say like bathroom or cookie or really simple things. And one of the questions that I had was when I originally started working with her, everything on her screen was a preferred item. So it might be bubbles, music, cookie, hug. I think she was maybe 4 years old. And so she would look at one and focus on it. And then she would get that thing. And my fear was, well, these are all things that she loves. How do we know she's actually being purposeful in choosing? And so what we did was we started introducing really boring things next to a picture of her preferred item. I think we started with an envelope. So it would be like music, her favorite song. I think she loved Taylor Swift, if I remember. Music, and then a picture of an envelope. And strikingly, she learned really quickly. to discriminate between those two things. And so anyway, we took data on it. This is a very long story, but we took data on it and presented it at a conference. And one thing that was really special was a couple years later, there was a family that reached out to me from somewhere in the Middle East. I can't remember which country, and told me that they had found that presentation and it helped their kid qualify for one of those eye gaze devices.
Wow.
So it's really, that was probably the most meaningful thing for me to see that kind of, I don't even want to call it research because it wasn't simple and the research design wouldn't pass muster in a journal, but to see it really have an effect
right
on a family. So
what was the May Institute?
That is, the May Institute was a, is a leading nonprofit that works with children with autism, developmental delays. And I worked for them in Nashville and absolutely loved it. Really okay. special group to work for. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So talking social media ethics again,
yeah.
that's where I first heard you on a podcast where you were going through your list, which I'd love for you to talk about that
yeah.
a little bit. Where did you first get interested in social media ethics? Because you would think that a lot of people, particularly over the past few years, there would be all of this stuff done on, you know, how to engage in a platform in a responsible manner where you're treating people with dignity and respect. But I don't know that I've heard too many people who've talked about it in the way that you've talked about it. So how did you land on the topic? And then yeah. I'd love for you to talk about what you've done.
So I've always been interested in public discourse. And the public square and how people communicate with one another, how they express their convictions. I think academia left me with a deep respect for, being able to discuss something without being personally triggered mm-hmm. and attaching yourself to it, because that's what you do in academia, right? You cover every issue, you play devil's advocate, you look at things from every angle.
You're writing dispassionately.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. There's, I think, a little bit of emotional removal, which isn't always a good thing, but that was certainly part of how I was formed. And then also this expectation that you better know what you're talking about, because if you start talking about things that you don't, you're going to be humiliated, first right. of all. And it's just not what you do. You know, everything is well-sourced. And if anything, maybe too much if you don't have, you know, the area of expertise is so narrow. I remember when I was working in the field of autism, somebody asked me a question about some kind of communication. And I was like, well, my area of expertise is really in this tiny nuanced part of functional communication. And really, like, I think you can get tunneled, maybe unnecessarily, but social media was kind of the opposite, right? Like everybody is an expert tweeting from their toilet or, you know, wherever right. they are. And truly, I mean, it's sad to say this, but I was just so crushingly disappointed by what I was seeing. You know, I'm a Christian. I lead in our church, and I had so many friends inside and outside the church that would find screenshots of crazy things, whether it be from a different leader in the city of Charlotte or someone that we knew or some random person on Twitter. And they would say, Kim, who are these people? Come get your crazy people. Look at what they're saying. And I don't know what it is about. I don't know if it's the anonymity that behind your screen, you're not looking into the eyes of someone, but I was just seeing behavior that really, really disturbed me. And I had a strong conviction that your words are your words and you don't get to say, it's just the internet, right. you know? So I created this kind of list of hopefully applying things that I think are truth to the nuances of social media that are helpful for me when I post and hopefully for our faith community too.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about some of the concerns that you have today
yeah.
and given kind of where we've been over the past couple of years, there's been so much going on, a lot going on right now, but what concerns you? And then I'd love for you to share some things from your list if you could,
sure.
if you would do that.
Yeah. I think that, you know, expressing conviction is actually really important. I think we need more boldness, not less. Mm. So I don't want to misspeak on that. I certainly advocate for things that I'm passionate about. I would encourage everyone to do that. But I think it's really important to know what you have the right to be heard on, if that makes sense. We all have a right to speak, which is extraordinary and rare, and we take it too much for granted. But that doesn't mean that you have the right to be heard, you know? And I think knowing, knowing what you have the right to speak on, earning the right to be heard, and then doing it in a way that is really respectful and, you know, where you can be heard. I think that, you know, I'm a Christian. And so to me, the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is so powerful. There's these three guys who are refusing to go along with government overreach, right? They're being told you have to do something that was against their moral, religious, firmly held conviction. And they're going to be burned alive because they're not doing it.
Yeah.
And there's this section in scripture where they're addressing the leader. And they're saying, like, we firmly disagree with you, but they're still respectful. And it's just, I think they reference him as O King. You know, they still give him his title. They still speak to him in a way that's really, really convicting for me, you know, as they're about to face their death in opposition and civil disobedience. And that's a really high standard. But if you claim to follow Jesus, that's what I expect of myself and of others. And if you're outside the church, you should hold people inside the church to that standard. And that was just not what I was seeing on the internet. Far from it. So
how would you describe what you've watched? I mean, you're paying close attention to what people are talking about, and you had to dive into it a little bit with people saying, you know, Kim, who are these people?
Yeah.
But what are you seeing that really concerns you?
Yeah. Name calling. One of the things on my list is that you need to have, you know, the Bible gives us this standard of having 2 to 3 witnesses to make an accusation. And so people using unsourced media that's really outlandish. I think in general, the issue of this makes me feel good, or this gives my team a point, or this makes the political opposition look really silly, so therefore I'm going to post it instead of, is it true? You know, that should be the first question of, is it true? Not, do I like it? Or does it make me feel good? Or does it make me feel justified? Or does it validate my hatred for, you know, this president or this political candidate or this leader or my neighbor? So just a lot of that name calling, wild accusations, things that were blatantly untrue, total misuse of statistics. My husband had to calm me down a few times because I told him that I was going to start every time I saw somebody post a graph or a stat, I was going to ask them to compute a confidence interval if they were so confident in their ability.
Oh, wow.
And he said, Kim, watch your ego. But I think there was just this sense of, really letting things fly that folks don't really have the ability to speak on. You know, and for myself too, I think we all get, I had one time that I was almost really, I almost stepped in it really big. I really care about human trafficking, but I'm not an expert.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I care about. I've read books on, but I don't know very much about relative to many people who spend their life and their gifting on that really, really important issue. And I had read an article that really, really deeply concerned me. And I cried when I read it. It stirred something in my spirit. I thought, this really matters. This is important to me. And I was getting ready to click post, and I did a little more digging, and it wasn't true. You know,
oh, wow.
What I had read wasn't true. And I think that it comes from a well-intentioned place sometimes, but you still have to check it.
Yeah. I do want you to dive into some of your points, but
yeah.
I was having this conversation actually with a friend yesterday. Yeah. Over the weekend yesterday. He just threw out the question, you know, given where things are, because the way that news is reported today, you know, with the rise of various platforms for communication over the past 10, 15, 20 years, you know, some of the mainstream institutional ways of communicating the news they're not obsolete. You know, they're not, I mean, people, there's still a bunch of people that watch different news networks, but every, you know, TikTok or YouTube, it's just, that's changed the game for how you get news, right?
Yep.
So maybe you talk about this. I can't remember. Maybe you talk about this in your grid that you're using. But who do you trust? Mm. How do you, I want to ask you, where do you get your news sources from? So how do you engage with some level of trust, or just, or do you listen to everything with just skepticism?
Yeah.
Like, this may not be, and here you were reading this one thing and you thought it was true.
Yeah.
It sounded true.
It sounded true.
It wasn't.
And it aligned with my worldview. You know, I think, well, first of all, I try and not watch news. I try and read news.
Right.
And I think that helps a little bit, because so much is communicated through tone and body language and an anchor's visible disgust or delight, you know, that I don't need that. I want to read about what happened and when and why. So
can I ask you what, and if you don't want to tell me, we can edit this part out.
Sure.
Who are your, like, if you had a top three, two or three sources where you would go to first?
Reuters, AP. And then there's someone I actually follow on Instagram, and I'm going to butcher his name, but it's Moshe. And he was an award-winning news producer who's worked for conservative and liberal news. And he has this really extreme allegiance to the facts, where he doesn't give a lot of spin.
Mm-hmm.
So he curates the news in a way that I find really helpful.
Okay.
So I love following him. You know, I try and stay active. I'm not a super news junkie. I have friends who know everything that's going on all the time. That's certainly not me. But yeah, I definitely make a rule to read more than I watch or listen, because there's just so much that's communicated that I do not find helpful.
For you, is it daily news or weekly or
a couple times a week?
Okay.
Yeah.
You're not waking up and that's the first thing that you're doing.
No, I'm waking up to a screaming kid normally.
right, exactly. Yeah, or writing an op-ed piece from your rocking chair with the child.
Yes.
Okay, let's get into some of the specifics of your social media ethics grid that you're using, or the questions. Talk about any of the points. Talk about any of it.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is interesting about social media is the like function, because it's not very nuanced. And I have a pretty wide menu, I guess, of books and people that I like to read from and learn from. But that doesn't mean I agree with everything they say.
Right.
Nor should it. You know, I think it's important to read from all perspectives. But there are many, many, many times where someone will post something that I find part of compelling or thought-provoking, or I disagree with, but I like how they phrased it because it made me think. Or part of it's really funny. And I've struggled with, if I like this, is that an endorsement of this whole comment? Or even more broadly, this whole person's body of work that I may have a lot of problems with or disagree with.
And you may just know nothing about them.
Yeah. Or there's somebody completely random.
This piece that you were reading that you thought was true. I mean, did somebody send that to you?
Yeah. And I don't even remember what the publication was.
Okay.
But yeah, it just wasn't true. And
you were going to do more than just a like. You were going to repost.
Yes. Oh yeah. Okay. With, I'm sure, some kind of self-righteous diatribe.
Going back to the like, what is that doing chemically, psychologically to folks? Have you studied that much?
No, I've read a little. I actually just last week, so there are many people ahead of me on this, but I found out that you can, and I'm so not tech savvy, but I found out you can disable seeing the number of likes on things, which I actually did because I have so many people I love and who are younger than me, who I know really are battling that, you know, like looking at the number of likes, I can still see it on my page, but they can't see it on my page.
Right.
And I think that can help with some of that comparative nonsense. So I just disabled that. I didn't realize you could do it. But I think, I think that there's, We know that fear and anger and a lot of the things that motivate people for engagement drive the largest numbers of responses. And I think that's maybe what's happening in national news. Maybe that's what's happening with internet news, is that that's how you get people engaged. And I think that like button is kind of a powerful exemplification, if that's a word, of that it's just a really easy way to like. So I try and be really careful about like that, what I like and what I don't like. That was on that list. Trying to, unintentional truth telling still matters.
Okay.
That was something that was on my list, that if you don't understand something, don't post it. If okay. you're not sure if it's true, don't post it. It's better to be right.
At what level does somebody, would you say somebody actually has an understanding of something?
Yeah.
Without having a PhD or a master's, like,
right.
How do you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really, really good question. I think, pointing to people who know more than you,
okay.
I think is really important. And then asking someone, you know, a lot of us have people in our lives who do know. There's a young woman who I mentored for a long time. Now we're just friends because she's way more mature than me in every way. And she's finishing law school. And so if I have I'm passionate about immigration and I have passion about that and I have thoughts about that, I'm not an expert. I still think I should be able to talk about that, how it relates to following Jesus, how it relates to living in a country that's built on a lot of principles around immigration. But I check a lot of things with her, okay. you know, before I say things. So I think it's about the nuance in which you communicate too.
Hi friends, my name is Dr. Vinita Boswell and I'm the founder and CEO of the Valo Group. And I am the executive producer of the Netflix original documentary, Rooting for Runa.
Dr. Boswell believes in the power of purpose and it is that belief that is the driving force behind Valo Group.
The Valo Group is invested in purpose. And what that means is that we believe every person and every organization is profoundly born and built on purpose. So we believe that people and brands are trying to solve something in the world and provide solutions. The Valo Group leverages the power of purpose to work with organizations to position their branding in a really powerful way. We help organizations and people position their purpose in a way that they are able to share with others and ask others to surrender their stories as well. We believe that you should forget the money and forge the relationship.
Valo Group has collaborated with some incredible organizations who are all committed to bringing about positive changes in our world.
We recently have worked with multiple organizations on redesigning their revenue strategies and their rebrandings. One in particular is raising a significant amount of resources to fight the war on AIDS in Africa, and we helped them design a $25 million fundraising campaign. As a child of Indian immigrants who had the great fortune of living the American dream, I believe that people and brands are born with purpose. I've spent my career investing in people and organizations who want to leverage, discover, and articulate the why and the how in what they do. The work that the Valo Group does is really to serve everybody, and it is for everyone. If you'd like to learn more and are interested in leveraging the power of purpose, feel free to reach out to me. My email is Vinita, that's V-A-N-I-T-A, at thevalogroup.com. That's thevalogroup.com.
Are there a couple of, I don't want to get too far off topic.
Yeah.
I mean, this is related, but do you have like a cadre of friends that you kind of bounce ideas off of, or, hey, I'm thinking I'm going to post this, repost this, write about this?
Yeah.
Like this, not like this. Do you talk with, is there a group that you go to, or do you have two or three that like experts, subject matter experts that you always refer to before you post something?
You know, I'm not as active of a poster to where I have anything that structured, but I do have a group of, I guess I'm really blessed to have a lot of pretty extraordinary people in my life who anytime I'm trying to understand something, you know, there was recently there was a publication about early childhood education and Head Start maybe not working. And, you know, one of my closest friends has a master's in that and from Duke and is incredible and knows everything and works in that field. And I was able to call her and she said, yeah, that doesn't explain anything at all. Let me tell you what's actually going on. I said, you know, we have a lot of friends from Davidson who are physicians and just different people that I can ask questions of. And I've really found that people are honored when you ask them.
Okay.
I think when we get kind of entrenched into our preconceived ideas, or this is what it means to be a Republican, or this is what it means to be a Democrat, or this is what it means to be a Christian, or this is what it means to be a Southerner, or whatever, we can miss out on a lot of really good conversation. And I was actually just talking to my mom this week about it, that every time I've gone to a friend with expertise about an issue, really without fail, the first thing they've told me is it's complicated. Mm-hmm. If you go to an immigration attorney, the first thing they'll tell you is it's complicated. During the early days of COVID, I remember asking my sister-in-law and some of our friends who are doctors, and they kept saying, it's complicated. We don't know. It's complicated. We don't know. And I think that was really striking to me, that the people who know the most are the first to say how much they don't know about something. So that always gives me a lot of respect for someone when they're willing to say that they don't know.
Okay. What's next on the list?
Let me think. Name calling was a big one.
Yeah.
Name calling of elected officials, name calling of friends and neighbors. Those kinds of accusations that back to, you know, if you've ever watched VeggieTales, Shadrach and Benny, you know, they weren't calling names. And I think there's a place for bold correction.
Okay.
And there's a way to say, like, this behavior is unacceptable. This is a violation. This is going to be called out in the strongest possible terms.
Okay.
Without calling someone a name. And that's the difference between, like, bold dialogue and really unhindered depravity.
Have you seen friends or colleagues or maybe even people at your church who it surprised you that they were calling someone a name publicly?
Yes.
And how do you address that? How have you addressed that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that on my list was about people in leadership, and it actually scared me when I read in scripture that I'm an elder at my church, and you know, elders and leaders are held to such a high standard in scripture that they're supposed to be corrected publicly for things. And I almost quit right then. You know, it's like, oh man, I hate being embarrassed and humiliated. Oh, wow. And I also have a lot of convictions and maybe sometimes a big mouth, and I'm setting myself up for a lot of public correction with this. Maybe this is not the role for me. But I think, that really shocked me that we are open to public correction. I try to not do that. I try to handle things privately. The very few times that I have seen things in my faith community that I felt like needed to be handled. I think it really is surprising, but not if we're honest about ourselves, because I know some of my most crazy thoughts, if I were to let myself go on the internet, right, I think I'd probably shock some people too.
Okay.
So I think it's about self-control, which I remind myself and my children of all the time, that's a sign of maturity is self-control. And I think that's something that I really, there's things that you squash even in your own brain that shouldn't see the light of day. There's things you can vent to your spouse about. There's things you can text your friends about. There's things you can say at the dinner table. And then there are things that should be on the internet. And I think people get those really mixed up, you know, really, really mixed up.
Well, so let's say, what happens then if, okay, so you're, you know, it's late at night and you're just like, I'm just going to go ahead and post this. And then you wake up the next day and like, oh my gosh, I should never have said that. So how do you, and you realize it. So how would you encourage somebody to correct that? It's out there, you know, forever.
Yeah.
So how would you deal with that? What would you tell them to do or not to do?
I have never had more respect for someone when they apologize publicly.
Okay.
In fact, that's something that it's really hard for me. I'm not a great apologizer, but I'm trying so hard for my kids to see that. I think that's a really, really powerful thing when a child sees their parent apologize to them and repent and, take ownership for what they've done. The few times that I have seen that, I can't even describe the level of affection that I feel for someone. And I think normalizing changing your mind, you know, we villainize people who change their minds.
Right.
And I think that is problematic for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? You're right.
Yeah.
But why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think that in a positive way, maybe there's a value of steadiness and consistency that we find really comforting. If you want to look at it cynically, I think that we see being wrong as weakness.
Okay.
And that we're attracted to power.
Or even just changing your mind.
Sure. And saying I was wrong.
Okay.
I think that we're attracted to power and that some people see changing your mind as weakness. I remember, just to tell another story about my dad that he'll roll his eyes at, but I remember I was struggling with just a topic, and I was reading a book about it, and it really struck me, and I handed the book to my dad, and he read the book, and he finished it, and he looked at me, and he said, "That changed my mind." Mm. And his opinion didn't become a carbon copy of mine. It wasn't a complete 180 from his previous position, but he was open. And, I think about myself at his age accomplished what he has accomplished. And I hope that that is me. I hope that I can read a really compelling, well-sourced book, with a great spirit behind it, and think, hey, that changed my perspective a little bit.
Are you seeing, this, you can get really particular or not here, but are you seeing, you said you've loved public discourse.
Yeah.
You think it's important.
Yeah.
Have you seen some good examples of that in 2022?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there are, I'm so extraordinarily proud of my pastor at our church. Okay. He leads as a cultural leader. I really haven't seen many people like him. He's just exceptional. He has his convictions and he's firm in them, but he just, leads in a way that's really respectful, from a place of service that's really exceptional. So I definitely think of him. There's somebody else I follow on Instagram named Sharon McMahon, who, if you're not following Sharon Says So, you need to be. She's an AP government teacher who decided to teach adults how things work.
She has a podcast, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And she's really, really, really special. And I've learned again, how does a bill become a law? Because the Schoolhouse Rock video is playing fuzzy in my brain. But she does such a beautiful job of explaining things in a way that's both passionate and dispassionate at the same time. I'm not sure if that's the right way to say it. But she has, again, a really special allegiance to the facts and, really strong patriotism that's not defined by ideological purity. I'm pretty savvy, and I can't even tell where she lands politically. So Okay. Yeah, she's special.
How did you come to this grid?
Yeah.
Looking at, social media, we need to consider these things versus not doing it this way or doing it this way. So how did you, was it intuitive? Was it you studying just human behavior? How did you arrive at this?
It was just a list of bad examples and a counter to them. I think that's really what spurred it. And then my own temptations, own, I like to be seen as someone who knows something.
Right.
And I think that can tempt me to want to be a part of public discourse on things that maybe there are better voices out there than mine on almost everything. There's a few things that I have the right to be heard on, and I should probably stick to those.
So if somebody, is listening to this podcast and they're like, okay, I'd like to get a hold of that list. How do they reach out to you? How would they do that?
So I have no public anything, but you can send me a private DM on Instagram. And it's at KIMUICH, MUHICH. And I would love to, I'll shoot it to you for sure. It's just a Word document that, again, I actually remember my 2-year-old dumping, I think, 3 bowls of cereal and milk on the floor as I was writing it. So it's rough, but that is life right now.
Okay. You've got this interesting story, just to shift gears a little bit, about the house that you and Andy live in that you bought recently. Which is an incredible story. We're talking about this at breakfast time. Yeah. Can you share, how did you get this house?
Sure. So, we've lived in the area for a good while, and I'd like every, white woman in her 30s, I spend way too much time on Zillow, browsing Zillow. And I found this really precious house that was a mile from the college campus where my husband and I went to college. And I was stalking it every time my kids wouldn't nap. I'd put them in the car and turn on Baby Shark and drive up to this driveway. And I'd look in the windows. It was empty. It had been empty for a really long time.
Pause there just a second. Baby Shark, obviously our kids are older now. We miss that. But I hear that's like every... if you're your age with small kids, Baby Shark is just a household name, right?
I am so grateful that Lin-Manuel wrote Encanto, because I prefer We Don't Talk About Bruno to Baby Shark to like the nth degree. So I need to do something to thank him. Not that he needs my thanks, but it is so nice to have a replacement to Baby Shark. But
okay, sorry, I used Baby Shark, and I've been hearing that a ton.
Yeah.
Anyway, go back into your story.
So I loved this house, and I would go draw on graph paper what I thought the rooms looked like. It's just a brick home near a college.
So you're looking
campus
at the house, and you think you know what they should look like?
Or yeah. Okay. I mean, I'd watched way too much Chip and Joanna Gaines, I think that I could take out this wall, which is funny because I have no skill set to do that kind of work. So we finally asked our friend who's a realtor to show us the house. We walked through it. We loved it. And we went home. I'm super pregnant with our third baby, so really emotionally unstable, hormonal, just an absolute mess. And my husband woke up in the middle of the night and he saw me crying, having this meltdown. He said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I'm so nervous about whether this is the right thing. And I'm asking God to give us an either accepted or a rejected offer. And my husband, who is an ordained pastor, so I'm really throwing him under the bus in a serious way here, told me, "Well, nice faith, but that's not how buying a house works. It's going to be a negotiation. Get ready, get your big girl pants on. This is going to be a back and forth." And the next morning he called me. I think I was reading a book to my kid.
Knowing Andy, I just can see how he's saying that.
Yeah, totally. And I'm reading a book to our kids, and he calls me. He says, "Sit down. The house is Dr. Palmer's." And Dr. Palmer was a beloved professor of mine at Davidson who wrote all my grad school recommendations. He introduced me to the field of autism, and he came to our wedding, gave us this framed poem that now hangs in the house. And it was just, it was really, really special. So I wrote him this really emotional, unhinged letter about all the ways he'd changed my life and what an extraordinary man he was. And I gave it to Andy, and he cried and read it and said, "You cannot send this. This is emotional blackmail. You cannot do this with a lowball offer on this man's house." So I ditched the beautiful, tear jerking, over the top letter, and I wrote a funny one. And he told his realtor, give it to him for whatever they asked. And it's just been really, really special to be in his house. Yeah, pretty wild.
Yeah, you were telling that story over breakfast, and I was amazed. So how cool is that? Mm-hmm. So let's go back. Let's say you're talking to an 18, 19-year-old student who's considering getting into a career field where they're not just interested in social media ethics, but also a host of things that you have pursued, from applied behavioral analysis, working with children, families with autism, being a consultant. What are some things that, if I'm 18 years old and I'm going to school, that I need to be thinking about? What do I need to be studying? Mm. What do I need to be prepared for? Maybe what do I need to have considered, prior to arriving at school? How would you prep them?
One thing that really strikes me as an adult is how many things I didn't know were things when I was a high school kid. How many jobs I didn't know were jobs.
Okay.
How many leadership needs there were that I didn't know were needs. And I think...
Can you give an example?
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons why I was interested in being a doctor is because I had been in a doctor's office.
Okay.
When I came... I've seen that, right? I've experienced that as a high school kid. I didn't know anyone with autism. So that was a whole world that I didn't even know existed. Mm-hmm. I think there's a very small number of career fields that kids see and they're familiar with. And there's so much more out there than we are aware of at that time. And I also, going back to this idea that leadership or impact or pursuing a passion is very often not tied to a job title. And I think that's something that I would certainly want to tell myself at 18 or 19, that it sounds cliche, but sometimes cliches are cliches because they're true. It's so much messier than you think it's going to be. I feel like that has been my story with lots of different things that I've been involved in, or tried to pursue or tried to make impactful change in, that it is often messier, but leadership and passion, like those are parts of who you are, not necessarily positions that you pursue. And there was this moment, it's a little bit off topic, but my pastor, who I deeply respect and love, his wife is like one of my top 10 favorite people, and he's a few slots below her, but he's still pretty high. He met with me at the end of COVID, and you know, the last couple of years have been, I shouldn't say the end because maybe we're still in it, but the last couple of years have been hard for many. And I think for me, I turtled inward, and it was about surviving with my three kids. And I had stepped back from almost every leadership opportunity that had been afforded me. And he sat down and he looked me in the eye and he got weepy, because he always gets weepy, which makes me get weepy. And he said, you know, Kim, you were made to lead. And if you don't start doing it again in some way, my fear is you're going to be a really miserable mother. And I think, I'm sure there was, I mean, I know that there was encouragement and compliment in there, but there was also a really important caution and truth telling, that I think is really important. And we all need those people around us, whether we're 18 or in their 30s or 50s or however old, to tell us who we are. And you know, Mike's wife is this extraordinary artist and writer, and she can't contain it. She needs to be doing it. That's how she was made. She was made to make things beautiful. And just like she shouldn't contain that, I can't contain my passion and voice. So I'm still working out what that means in this season of life. It's not a formal thing like I thought it'd be at 18. You know, when you're 18, you think, I'm going to have three kids and I'm going to be super present and I'm going to be killing it in some leadership position and I'm going to be changing the whole world. And I'm also going to, you know, you think you're going to do it all at the same time.
Right.
And you can't do it all at the same time. You can't do it excellently all at the same time, but you can do things in a creative and innovative way.
I was going to ask you, kind of already answered the question, sort of. I was going to ask you, you know, if you could go back and talk to your 18-year-old self, you know, what kind of conversation would you have? And maybe you could speak more to that, but listening to you, I want to say, what do you think you would say, what would you say yes to maybe more than you did, you know, that many years ago? Or what would you say no to?
Yeah.
From a career standpoint or whatever.
Yeah.
Personal or professional.
Yeah. I think I wish I had said yes to more things that didn't sound as impressive then. You know, I will say over and over again that I think the most undervalued leaders in our society are classroom teachers. Just extraordinary. And when I think about leadership potential, I can't even think about my daughter's first grade teacher without crying. She's just so incredibly special. And she leads one of the most important people in my life for the majority of her waking hours. And she does it with excellence and with beauty and passion. And they're so chronically underpaid. And I think graduating from schools like Davidson and UT, becoming a teacher wasn't really respected in the same way that other things were. And I did teach for 3 years, and that was some of the most formative, extraordinary work that I have ever done. And I'm very proud of it, and I'm very grateful for it. And I think I have a much more rounded view of what it means to be a leader and what it means to do something that really matters. The same thing with, you know, changing diapers all day.
Yeah.
I think, I think I would encourage myself to not be afraid to say yes to things that that maybe seem different than what I thought they would be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Is there something that you would have said, okay, we're just theorizing here or hypothetically speaking, that you would have gone back and said, no, I'm not going to pursue that, or I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. I think some of the, you know, I started a doctorate, I think, mainly because I liked school and I liked research. But there was a lot of things about that that didn't match my passion for working with people on the ground. And maybe in some ways I was interested because it was impressive and was the next right step, or it seemed to be the next right step. Mm-hmm. So I think freeing myself a little bit from expectations of what I thought society wanted from me, or my pressures from within myself to achieve a certain thing. Again, I'm always amazed by people in more ordinary positions, ordinary lives that are really doing some incredible things. And I think it was the Apostle Paul, I'm going to get myself in trouble with heresy here, but I think he said something about trying to lead a quiet life, which is really that you should want to lead a quiet life. And I think, I don't think he meant, and don't do anything that matters or makes change. Obviously that's not the way he lived.
Right.
But I think not being driven solely by, what's impressive. And truly that's how I was raised. Even with my dad's crazy title, we were always taught to follow passion. You know, he loved to fly. He was passionate for that, and he had a gifting for that, and he could make an extraordinary difference doing that. And that's what drove his decision to do what he did. So trying to keep those priorities in check. Yeah, that's definitely a conversation I would have with 18-year-old Kim. Oh, and I would also tell her to marry that guy.
Okay. Yeah. And he's a pretty decent dude.
He's a good dude.
Yeah. So what kind of things, you know, given, again, you have limited margin.
Yeah.
It's a season of life. But you are quite engaged. I mean, the topics that we're covering today, I mean, you are quite engaged with what's going on. So what are some projects or things that you're working on in 2022 with your limited margin that bring you a lot of joy, that you're passionate about, or you're hoping to dive into more?
Yeah. One of the things that is not a project, but is a little practice that I'm doing right now is I'm trying to read every day, read for pleasure every day. And that includes, I have this stack of books.
You know, I want to ask you, what are you reading?
Yeah.
But keep going.
Okay. So right now I'm reading, if this gives you an idea, I'm reading a couple cookbooks because I like reading cookbooks for fun. I'm reading Andy Crouch's new book that I'm blanking on the title of. It's coming out in April.
Okay.
That's amazing, about relationship in a tech age. And you should pre-order it because it's phenomenal. I'm reading The Emotionally Healthy Church.
Is that Pete Scazzaro?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep. And I'm actually reading this old copy from a founding elder at our church who is that just like family. He's my oldest daughter's godfather. And so it was his copy, and then it has our pastor's notes in it. So I feel like I'm reading this beautiful, like, old artifact from the starting days of our church. So I'm reading that. I normally have a memoir going, and then I just read, our friends gave us a book called Once Upon a Wardrobe that's kind of a fictional retelling of part of C.S. Lewis's life. So I just read The Elimination of Hurry, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry.
Who wrote that?
John Mark Comer.
Okay.
So I'm always reading. And then of course, whatever, I think we're almost done with Charlotte's Web.
You started with two cookbooks.
Like, yeah.
So which cookbooks?
So I go to the library. This is the most undisciplined thing ever, but I go to the library with my kids after preschool pickup, and I look at what's like on the end cap and I grab them. And I do love to cook. That's one thing I don't get to do. It's more simple things, but I do love reading cookbooks for fun. So I'm reading. I'm an elder at our church, which is really kind of a unique position given my age and gender. And so that's as a project, really learning about leadership and change process and organizations, and but also on a deeper level, just what does it look like to be a part of a really healthy organism that's trying to be faithful to the values that we espouse, and that has been really formative so far, really extraordinary, really humbling, because a lot of these people I've looked up to since I was 18. I've been at the same church for 17 years. So that's something that a lot of my margin right now is spent there. And that's just a really special privilege. So,
Given your interests, which are vast, but you're really landing in this lane of talking about social media and ethics. I mean, are there some things that you experienced just growing up that kind of speak to, okay, this is why maybe I was so passionate about this topic or this issue?
I think
And you grew up in an unusual, I mean, your dad has seen, you know, the Earth from space, from the International Space Station, right?
Yeah. I think my parents, at their best, which was often, they treat people with a lot of dignity. That was something that was really valued. My dad is a really strong person of faith, and he was not someone who would shame you or bully you with faith. And I think in a lot of ways he was very winsome. You know, people were interested in what made him tick because they were interested in him and his character, his personality, in an environment that was not all, you might think would not be friendly to that. And I did not grow up thinking that. I never had an issue with science and faith, right? Because I saw it work together so beautifully. I never had an issue with like legalism and all these things that my parents really exemplified to me, what a faithful following of the person of Jesus of Nazareth looks like without all the other stuff layered on top of it. So it was a really special way to grow up, something that I feel very protective of, and not wanting to lose that in the caricatures of the internet and the mudslinging, while still bringing truth in a way that's important, and bold. Yeah. So, you know, my parents, are not people who seek public voice. That's just not who they are. They probably should, because they're wonderful leaders. But I think that this kind of drive that I have to engage or consume responsibly, maybe it's just a result of seeing the brokenness that happens when we're not doing it right. So yeah.
I meant to ask you this question earlier. Are there some people that you would say probably you just don't need to be on social media?
Yeah.
I mean, because you hear different perspectives. Some people say, well, everybody needs to have a voice. Everybody needs to, you need to have, it's just what you do. It's how you even get a job. And I mean, you need to have this account here. But are there some people that you would say, you know what, it'd probably be best, and I don't mean just because, you know, someone may be prone to just posting crazy stuff, but who should be and who shouldn't be?
I think most people shouldn't be. I mean, maybe that's too strong. My brother's not on social media. My parents are not on social media. My husband's not on social media. I think, and honestly, they're out there living really important lives, being faithful to where they're called. My brother would tell you everyone should be off the internet. This is ridiculous. but I think, I mean, I remember reading an article, I think it was in Christianity Today, where they were like, please don't leave social media if everyone leaves.
I was trying to think of who wrote that article.
I don't remember.
Oh, I can't remember.
And I think it was compelling. I think it's important that we know what it is and what it isn't. I remember reading, I think it was Tim Keller, who was talking about like social media is about identity, like publicly stating your identity. It's not about having an argument or a discussion that's necessarily going to change someone's mind. And so for me, where I have found it to be useful is if there's something going on like refugee resettlement or the border separation policy or things that are happening in real time, to say, this is something that I as a Christian care about, that is effective as like an identity signaling. What's not effective is, and here's how you should change your mind and think like me.
Okay.
So I think I had a number of students that I used to work with in youth ministry or students that I have taught who reached out to me and said, I had no idea that Jesus cared about, you know, these things. That's not the Christianity I see. And so I think there's a place for that as like an identity signaling, but trying to change someone's mind, you're probably not going to do much. So, and then of course there's the precious, like here are my kids dressed up for Halloween or, you know, funny story about them or whatever, which then you got to be careful about what you're posting about your children and giving them the rights to their own autonomy, even when they're 4 and 6 years old. You know, I don't want them to hate me one day for publishing horrible things.
So here's a question that you were just saying, you know, you should care about these things, but when you get in to start telling, well, this is how you should do it, that's where it gets maybe
sticky,
a little sticky or complex. Yeah. But having said that, if I'm a parent, and I am a parent, my kids are older now, but if you're a parent and you're trying to think through, and your kids, you know, are young in grade school, how might I be, should I think about social media in my kids at this point?
I think the biggest thing is by example. I mean, my husband and I have talked about, like, we can't tell our kids they can't be on phones all the time if we're on our phones all the time.
Right.
So life is meant to be lived relationally and across a kitchen table from someone, not across a screen. And that's something that I think kids see more than they hear. So I think starting, if your identity is built on social media, how do you expect your children's to not be? Mm. So I think that that's something that we're really paying attention to. It's not an issue for Andy. He's nowhere near his phone ever, but it's just something I think today that you have to be paying attention to. And then until a kid's identity is really, if it's true that social media is about showing your identity and your identity isn't even formed yet because you're so impressionable and young, what are you doing on the internet? I mean, the internet is a really dark and scary place. I've had this reaction to a lot of parents who they don't want their kids to ride their bikes five blocks to a park to meet friends, but they'll give them unfettered access to the internet. Mm. And I just, that really, really, really concerns me. We know statistically that your kid is going to be fine driving to the park. I mean, every once in a while, there's a horrible tragedy, an accident, a kidnapping, and those things capture our imagination and attention because they're every parent's worst nightmare. But statistically, your child is in way more danger on the internet than they are riding their bike to the park. So I think understanding what kind of risks we're taking with our kids, which ones are worth taking, which are not. I cannot imagine a life where a child under 13 should be on social media. And that's why there's laws saying they shouldn't be.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Last question I have for you.
Yeah.
And again, thank you so much for coming to the studio. This has been so fun. What's next for you? I know it's a crazy busy season, but what's next?
Well, Travis, you invited me to come on this podcast and I shared this with you that I sent a screenshot of some of the people that you'd interviewed to one of my best friends. And she said, "Yay, we're finally famous. Wait, why are you going on this? Why do they want to talk to you?" And I said, I don't know. I think maybe it's like a shtick in 2022 to be a millennial who's been in the same church for 17 years. Maybe that's what we're talking about.
Wow.
But maybe that's my brand. Like maybe I could write a book. I don't know. But we giggled about it. So thank you for having me on with all these amazing people. It's been a really great experience. But what's next for me is this weekend, my daughter is having her 7th birthday party and we're doing a fairy garden theme. So I'm going to be doing a lot of cutting fake moss and working through stuff with our precious church is going to be a big part of the next couple years. Maybe writing.
Okay.
Maybe writing.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see.
Are you trying to carve out time? I mean, we talked about your recent writing experience, but when is the best time for you to devote to any kind of writing?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. What it has been is me on a very old laptop in my son's nursery while he destroys. I've sent pictures to friends of just, he has this thing. I don't know. It's my third baby. I should know by now, but he like, I'll fold laundry and he'll dump it out. And that's a game. I don't know how that's a fun game, probably because of my reaction, which I'm sure is measured and beautiful and mature. I sent a picture to a friend of piles of dirty and clean laundry intermixed, probably some diapers in there as I'm like trying to write something on a laptop. So I haven't quite figured anything out besides like 130 character op-ed.
Okay.
130 words, maybe not characters. Okay. That's a tweet. Which I'm not on Twitter,
right.
But I think, trying to figure out some balance with some writing. Back to the truth telling thing, one of my dearest friends sat me down on a park bench, you know, a few months ago and she said, "You need to write essays on friendship."
Okay.
And I don't know about that, but it was, those are the kinds of risks in relationship that really matter. I think people telling you the truth about yourself.
If you had more time, I mean, is that what you would write about?
Maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe. As you can tell, I'm a, not even a jack of all trades, like an attempter of all trades, master of none. So, I think that's something that relationships really anchor me in. The people who tell you the truth about yourself when you can't see it. I think it was maybe Justin Gibney who said something about giving flowers to people while they can still smell them. Mm. That really resonated with me, and it's a value that I have because of what it's done for me when people have done that for me. And so I tried to embrace that this year, which is why I burst into tears every time I see my kids' teachers and trying to tell them who they are and what they've done. And yeah.
Well, if there were ever a season for friendship, I mean, today is a day where people need friends.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for coming
Travis.
On the show. It's been an honor.
Thank you.
And please drive safely back to Charlotte.
Okay.
I know you've got some stuff later today. So
car anyway, line in 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, take care. Thank you.
Thanks, Travis.
Voyager is brought to you by Core Media Source. Editing and mixing by Kevin Duthu. Recording and studio coordination by Beth Grabencourt. Songs used on Voyager include Like the Ocean by The Big Letdown and Could Be Anyone by Courses. All music provided by Epidemic Sound. Join us every Wednesday to journey through the lives and minds of creative visionaries, artists, and innovators who are changing the world with their work.